It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's International Workers' Day. We'll find out why May 1st is considered Labor Day in most countries, not here in the United States.
First, Congress unveiled a $1.1 trillion spending bill this morning with bipartisan support. The bill includes additional defense spending and a boost for border security, but it does not include money for President Trump's promised border wall.
This comes after Congress voted to extend federal funding for another week past its midnight deadline, avoiding a federal government shutdown.
Russell Berman is with us now to talk about this news. He's a senior associate editor for The Atlantic, where he covers politics. Russell, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, last night, Democrats and Republicans struck this bipartisan deal for a funding measure to keep the government up and running, and they've got about a week to hammer out the details. But so far, what do we know about what's in it?
Well, we know there's more money for defense, up to $15 billion for the military. That is something that President Trump wanted, although it's only about half of what he requested. There's also a little bit of money, $1.5 billion, for border security, also what he requested. But besides that, there isn't much for the president to, to qualify as a victory. This deal looks a lot like what President Obama might have struck with Republicans in Congress. The current president, President Trump, didn't get any of the $18 billion in cuts to domestic agencies that he wanted. As you mentioned, he did not get funding for the border wall. He didn't get any provision that would threaten money for so-called sanctuary cities. The law will still allow funding to go to Planned Parenthood, which is something that Republicans have been trying to cut for many years. So Democrats were actually declaring more of a victory this morning than Republicans.
Right. Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had been silent. Have they said anything about this? And do you have any thoughts about how they're digesting the deal so far?
You know, they've pointed to sort of the limited wins that they got, which is, as I mentioned, the additional money for the military and defense spending, a little bit of additional money for border security. Paul Ryan, the speaker, was also very happy that Democrats relented on a demand that they had made for several years, which was that any time Congress increased money for defense, they would put in an equivalent amount of money for domestic agencies. That one-to-one ratio was not maintained in this deal. Democrats did get some money for domestic agencies, but not as much as was added for defense.
Now, you said President Trump, not a lot for a victory there for the White House. On Sunday, President Trump appeared on CBS's Face the Nation, and he said, "I think the rules in Congress, and in particular the rules in the Senate, are unbelievably archaic and slow-moving and in many cases unfair. Looking at the outcome of this budget negotiation, looking at the president's priorities and what ended up, as far as we know, in this spending deal, is the president facing a learning curve as a Washington outsider?"
Yes, he is. I mean, he's just the latest in a long line of recent presidents to complain about the rules in the Senate. In this case, they were limited by the filibuster, which is maintained for legislation, even though Republicans got rid of it for Supreme Court nominations a few weeks ago. But the legislative filibuster remains, and that means that they needed at least 8 Democrats to pass a bill to fund the government and to avoid a shutdown. And Democrats, frankly, used their leverage to their advantage and got a lot of what they were looking for, considering the government now is run entirely by Republicans.
We're talking with Russell Berman, senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers politics, and we're talking about the federal spending plan released this morning. And looking ahead, what do you think in terms of strategy this deal means for Republicans? They didn't get the shutdown, which might have been a hit, seeing that they control both chambers of Congress. Or are they saving their strength for a fight down the road?
That's what it appears. They were not in any mood for a big showdown that would have led to a government shutdown. Democrats, frankly, were pretty happy to give them a shutdown if they wanted to, because they were confident that the Republicans and President Trump would, if not take the entire blame, they would at least suffer a pretty big embarrassment. And so this spending bill only covers the remaining 5 months of the fiscal year. So once the fall comes around, once September comes around, they're going to do this again for the full year of funding for the fiscal year 2018, which begins October 1st. And as of right now, we would expect to see a much bigger fight from Republicans and from the Trump administration for that border wall funding and for some of their other priorities.
And does this preliminary spending measure, does it tell you anything about what kind of leverage Democrats might have when the stakes are a little higher and maybe Republicans are fighting a little harder?
They're still going to have a fair amount of leverage. You know, Republicans, their majority in the Senate is only 52-48. They'll need 8 Democrats for spending bills. And their leverage is increased because the Republicans on a regular basis can't rely on the votes of these Freedom Caucus members, these fiscal or spending hawks, in the House and a few of them in the Senate. They'll vote against any bill that spends money that they don't like. The cuts that they would demand are simply not going to be made on a bipartisan basis. And so that gives the Democrats even more leverage because Republicans can't even count on all of the members of their own party to vote for the legislation that they put forward.
Has there been any reaction from the president, from the White House, about this so far?
There hasn't been much official reaction. The president did say in an interview with Bloomberg News, he said he's very happy about the spending deal and that he plans to sign it, assuming it doesn't change from here on out in the next few days, which it's not expected to. The Republicans can be happy that they averted a government shutdown and that they, you know, have shown that they can operate the government and work to some extent with Democrats. At the White House, Press Secretary Sean Spicer did point to the down payment, as he called it, for border security, and did point to the added defense money. Those were clear, if modest, victories for Republicans in this bill. Although, as I mentioned, just Democrats had a lot more to cheer.
About this time last week, we were talking about how the president very strongly wanted funding for the border wall included in this spending measure. That didn't happen. It fell away. What do we know from this experience about how that might take shape down the road?
So the dirty little secret about the border wall is that it does not enjoy unanimous support among Republicans on Capitol Hill. And so he didn't have a united party who certainly they didn't want to make this fight right now. And looking ahead to the fall, it's not clear that he'll have a united Republican Party wanting to make this fight then either, in large part because many of the members in both the House and the Senate who represent either states or districts where the border wall would go through, they don't support the border wall. They might support some additional fencing. They might support more security, more technology on the border, but this idea of this huge, massive structure that might go through private land, that might go through national parks or other, Native American lands, you know, very complicated to put together and very expensive. And there's just more opposition than simply in the Democratic Party to it. And so, you know, it's no guarantee that he's going to get this money next time around.
And Russell, any preview for a revised Republican health care bill, which there's rumbles that this is beginning to approach readiness? They say it'll come to a vote when the votes are there. But what are we thinking about that right now?
Yeah, this has been like a summer heat storm, a little like a low rumble of thunder for the last few weeks. But it's, again, still not clear that they have the votes. The key in Congress is if they had the votes, they would schedule a vote, and they haven't done that yet. Republicans are pushing. They're talking with their members. They got the Freedom Caucus on board last week with the revised American Health Care Act, but that those changes alienated some of the moderates. And so according to the whip counts that some of the Beltway press, newspapers and websites are tallying, the Republicans are right at that magic number of 20, 21, 22 votes that they can't afford to lose anymore, and there's still many members who are publicly undecided. So we haven't seen a vote scheduled in the House, and we likely won't see a vote scheduled in the House until they are very sure that it will pass.
Russell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Russell Berman, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, where he covers politics. And he joined us to talk about the federal spending plan released this morning.
and much of the world, today is celebrated as International Workers' Day or Labor Day. Here in the U.S., of course, Labor Day is celebrated as the first Monday in September.
Paul Secunda joins us now to talk about why and to compare the labor movements in the U.S. and abroad. He's a professor of law and director of the Labor and Employment Law Program at Marquette University Law School. And Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back. Great day to be back.
Well, and Paul, let's start with the basics. What is International Workers' Day?
So International Workers' Day, also known as May Day, is basically about commemorating, celebrating trade unionists and their successes in bringing leisure time back to the working class, 8-hour workday, the weekends, things that we take for granted today. The original International Workers' Day was a protest by socialists and communists, interestingly enough, against the conviction of 8 radical labor activists in connection with Chicago's Haymarket Square riot all the way back in 1886. And since then, it was subsequently appropriated by the Soviet bloc through the 1980s. And now more recently, it's taken on an immigration orientation with all the immigration issues that we have floating around.
And so given that backstory, why is it celebrated late in the summer instead of today in this country?
Well, in this country, I think initially we did not want to be associated with the Soviet bloc, so we didn't want to be seen as celebrating anything that socialists and communists were being that were celebrated. And so instead, they used it as kind of an end of the summer ritual, the end of the holiday, the beginning of work, and of course, most importantly, as you probably know, you can't wear white after Labor Day now.
Those are interesting things to think about when you look at the global picture. So, looking at nationwide. Is it a celebration or is it an observance? How is it observed elsewhere?
Well, I think it is a celebration and an observance. Elsewhere, it is observed like it is here with marches, parades, celebrations, but it's also a march for immigrants' rights. Today, I've seen that there's an estimated 259 events planned in some 200 cities, including Washington, D.C. Interestingly, some of the larger employers, some of the social media employers, Google and Facebook, have given their employees the green light to protest today without fear of punishment. So I think employers understand this is a good way to allow their employees to vent their concerns that they have and to also celebrate all the great work that workers do around the country.
And you mentioned the Immigration Association and some ties here in this country. Is that also true abroad? Does it have that Immigration Association elsewhere?
Well, I can only speak about a few countries in that regard. I did live in Australia a couple of years ago. Interestingly enough, they have their Workers' Day in March for their own reasons. So everyone has, you know, different dates sometimes and not always May Day. But similarly there are immigration issues as far as people immigrating to Australia and there being all sorts of laws and regulations making it difficult. So I have seen immigration protests in Australia. Canada, which actually also has its Labor Day in September, doesn't have the same immigration issues currently that we do. So it's not as a big of an issue there.
If you look at the United States and Wisconsin in particular as part of this big picture, it seems as though the labor union or the labor movement, I should say, is in decline from some perspectives. Is this also the case elsewhere?
Well, it's certainly true here in Wisconsin and the United States. Both in the public sector and the private sector, union density has declined over the last 20 to 30 years, and maybe most dramatically over the last 5 years. It is true in some of what I will call the other Commonwealth countries, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, although there are other countries, in particular the Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Denmark. Easy for me to say. Where there's been high union densities for a long time, and these are some of the most successful economies. I would say that even in those countries that have lower union rates, not as many or as low as ours, for instance, whereas our overall union density rate for the private sector is about 6.5% right now. In Canada, it is closer to 17% and about 15% in Australia. So even though other countries have seen a decline in union membership, union activity, I think that the most precipitous drop has been here in the United States.
So what factors do you see behind that shift? And do those factors also align with what you're seeing in other countries who may have a higher union density than we have but also are seeing a decline?
Yeah, I think it has to do with the role that the employers play. In a lot of other countries, employers do not take an active role in whether or not workers organize. Also, the government's involved, and the government being involved lends an air of neutrality. And so it's not as political in other countries. Here, employers, with a few exceptions, are very anti-union. One of the parties, the Republican Party, is extremely anti-union as far as passing various types of laws, so-called right-to-work laws, laws that make it hard for unions to collect dues from members. So I do think it's a much more adversarial relationship here among labor and management. And to be frank, management has been winning, and the laws and the decisions have really favored corporate interests in the last decade or so.
We're talking with Paul Secunda right now from Marquette University Law School, talking about the labor movement in the U.S. compared to the rest of the world on this International Workers' Day. And, Paul, if you look at, say, politics and who's in control, which party, you can often say, well, politics has a cyclical nature to it, or a pendulum, that it swings from one side to the other. Is the same true of the rise and fall of unions, or is it more of a straight line going up and down?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it depends on what our time period is. Since the early 1980s, it's been going pretty much straight down, even though, of course, there's been both Democratic and Republican presidents. I think this has to do both with the global nature of our workplace, the fact that the American labor law has last been changed in 1959. So you're talking about almost 60 years without any change in the labor law. The labor law that we have today was put together at a different time during the New Deal in the 1930s when we had a very different economy. And I think what we really need is labor law reform, but because the two parties are at loggerheads and they can't agree on anything, we haven't had labor law reform in a very, very long time. And I think this has really caused significant harm to any kind of meaningful union density increase in the United States.
Yeah, can you talk a little more about that? So 60 years since we've seen changes in labor law in this country, what problems do you see associated with that, maybe on both sides, on the side of management, on the sides of workers?
Well, for me, the biggest problem is just the inability to sit down and compromise and hash out problems. Through a collective bargaining contract, through investigations and fact findings and mediations, you could resolve an issue fairly quickly without hard feelings and get back to work. Now, because these mechanisms have broken down and there are so few unions, we're seeing a lot more litigation. And litigation is not only expensive and time-consuming, but it also causes a very adversarial relationship in the workplace between those who are in management and those who are rank and file. So I do believe that the loss of the labor contract, the loss of unions, has led to more difficulty in managing disputes in the workplace and leads to really resources being spent in ways where they could be spent better as far as, you know, making the company profitable and raising the wages of workers.
And you were mentioning Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and that they had a more union membership and also strong economies. Are there takeaways to compare here to the United States economy, or is it apples and oranges?
No, I think there are takeaways. I think there's this belief in our country that if you have a union, management will lose power and they will become inefficient because they won't be able to run the workplace by themselves. But I do believe that when workers are involved, it's not a static pie. In other words, it's a win-win situation. Workers get involved, they become more productive, their morale increases, there's more for everyone to share. And I think the Scandinavian countries show that. And I also think that there are other countries who are doing quite well, like Germany, who also have very active, if not unions, kind of representational bodies, we call them work councils in Germany, that have proven to be very successful in harnessing that energy and making both the economy strong and making a little bit more equitable as far as how the profits are shared between the two groups.
So looking ahead into your crystal ball, what do you see for the future of unions? And you said, you know, politicians at loggerheads about this right now. So what is the path forward? What do you see?
Well, for the next, you know, administration, I think we're going to see more pressure on unions to find their way on their own, because we're likely to see unfriendly labor legislation, unfriendly people on the National Labor Relations Board. Unions are going to have to come up with new ways to persuade workers that joining their ranks is in their best interest. And I think that requires a new dialogue, a new understanding of what unions can do for workers. It's not just about what they can do for you in the workplace as far as wages and benefits and working conditions. It's also providing other types of services that people are interested in, whether it's buying a first house, being able to get a credit card with a good interest rate, or learning how to save for retirement. These are all types of services that unions can provide and be a voice for the workers in the global workplace of the 21st century.
And Paul, as we wrap up, do you see that happening, that appetite for innovation on the part of labor unions?
Oh, absolutely. Unions are talking about this at every conference they're having that I've been to, at least in the last 5 to 10 years. The best minds are at work to consider how to get workers back involved in the workplace debate. Because let's face it, without workers involved, what we're likely to see is more income inequality, and that's just going to cause more upset in the workplace.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
That was Paul Secunda, professor of law and director of the Labor and Employment Law Program at Marquette University Law School.
In elections around the world, there's been a trend. Rising success for leaders and parties who embrace populist and nationalist themes, strong rhetoric against perceived enemies, internal and external, and sometimes impatience with the rule of law. Think Erdogan in Turkey, Duterte in the Philippines, Putin in Russia, Modi in India, the list goes on.
Our next guest says this is a striking trend and one we should be worried about, because this kind of leadership tends toward violence, sometimes on a large scale. And he says we should be concerned about what's going on here in the United States.
Alfred McCoy joins us now. He's a professor of history at UW-Madison. His books include Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation, and the forthcoming In the Shadows of the American Century, the Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Al, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, Rob, a pleasure, pleasure.
Well, first of all, we gave a couple examples, but how widespread is this rise of populist leaders with authoritarian leanings?
I think right now probably more than a third of the population on the planet are living underneath leadership that either self-describes or can be described as populist. And then waiting in the wings beyond those that are actually in power are aspirant populist leaders bidding for power worldwide. It includes, of course, Putin in Russia, Erdogan in Turkey. You probably have to include Narendra Modi in India. Of course, President Duterte in the Philippines, and self-described President Trump in the United States. The White House proudly lays claim to that label, and they identify very closely with others to whom the label is applied. Putin in Russia, and of course, Duterte in the Philippines, and President Trump just had a long and friendly phone call with President Duterte over the weekend, a striking contrast to his predecessor's relationship with Duterte. Duterte famously called President Obama the son of a whore and virtually ruptured relations. Well, Trump now has a friendly phone call and has invited him to the White House, although Duterte says he might be a little bit too busy to squeeze it in. I think he's just playing a little bit hard to get. So in other words, it's not only a label that's applied to these leaders, but it's one that they embrace and they identify with each other around the planet. They identify with their style, their rhetoric, their disruptions, their nationalism, and although they don't talk about it, they seem to share an embrace of highly personalized violence that gives them the aura of the classic authoritarian, the classic kind of strongman leadership.
We'll dig into more of how that works in just a bit, but why now? Why do you see this trend in so many different countries now?
It's a reaction to worldwide globalization. Although the elites of the world and corporations benefited enormously from the spread of world trade and the ending of customs protections, the crashing of barriers to open trade and commerce and interaction, free flows of human beings, ideas, and goods, those that live in individual communities where factories have closed, and there are many places in Europe and the United States and elsewhere around the world where this is happening, they've suffered enormously. And there was an inattention, I think, to this transition. The idea was that, you know, and economists will tell you that this can be proved, that trade does improve income levels overall in a society. It improves productivity. It has many, many benefits, but what economists until very recently have minimized is that there are some real losers, some real costs. And we've seen, particularly since China joined the World Trade Organization back in 2001 and began racking up this incredible trade surplus, China's cost the United States over 2 million jobs, very strongly in the South and in the Midwest, all kinds of manufacturing jobs. That's happened in Europe as well. And so there's now a kind of nationalist reaction to this globalization, and the populist leaders have been embracing nationalism, projecting strength, and riding this tide all the way into the highest office in their respective countries.
Is the word uncertainty part of the story here? Even if someone hasn't lost their own job, they're seeing this happen around them and thinking, am I next? Am I the next one to be disrupted, to lose a job because of globalization?
I mean, I don't know about you as a broadcaster, but myself as an historian, I wonder, you know, if I'm not like a buggy maker in the 19th century as the automobile industry was starting. I mean, you know, is the open source, the Internet going to be taking our jobs away from us? Broadcasting, jobs have diminished. Everybody in every single profession is faced with enormous uncertainty as this major change. It's not only globalization, but it's also a driver of technology, of the efficiency of modern industry, is just eating up enormous numbers of jobs. And that's, of course, workers don't see the invisible forces of technological change. Okay, that's difficult to discern. What they do see is these foreign products arising. They see immigrants arriving. And they unfold all of these processes of change that are, in many cases, have worsened their lives and limited their opportunities. They blame it on these global forces, and they naturally embrace nationalism as an alternative.
Talking to historian Alfred McCoy from UW-Madison, looking at the rise of populist leaders, elected leaders often showing authoritarian tendencies. And Al, in the piece you wrote on this that I mentioned earlier, and you briefly touched on this earlier, the idea of violence being present or just around the corner, performative violence is a phrase you use in that piece. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's one thing that they all share. They either have or are engaged in not only very violent rhetoric, which they all seem to have, but actual violence. Okay, take President Putin. Over the past 10 years, a surprising number of his prominent opponents have been killed. The opposition leader Nemtsov was gunned down in the shadow of the Kremlin in 2015. Back in 2006, a very well-known journalist, Anna Politkovskaya, I shared a podium with her in London in 2004. 2 years later, she was gunned down outside her apartment. The latest killing was in March in Kiev. A refugee politician who was an opponent of Chernyshev was blown away in a spectacular shootout, 20 bullets fired in the streets of Kiev. There's no attempt to conceal anymore. And this adds to Putin's aura of strength that anybody who crosses him in Russia is a dead man. You can see this with Duterte in the Philippines. He emerged from a provincial city, a very rough city, arguably the most violent city in that very violent country back in the 1980s. And during his 22 years as mayor, he presided over a death squad that killed nearly 1,000 people. When he was running for office, he promised in 2016 presidential campaign that he would kill 100,000 drug dealers and drug addicts if necessary. And since he's taken office, there have been 8,000 people gunned down in the streets of the Philippines. And many of them not only have these signs saying, you know, I'm a pusher, but they also are wrapped in this eerie kind of brown commercial wrapping tape. The faces are kind of mummified in this tape. And this was a signature that his Davao death squad developed in the late 1990s when they killed those 1,000 people. So these leaders not only talk violence, but they project their power by engaging in actual violence.
And there seems to be, at least in some of these cases, public support for that deployment of violence.
This is the contradiction. You know, whereas the international community is quite justifiably appalled by Duterte's extraordinary violence. 8,000 people gunned down in extrajudicial killings across the capital, a clear violation of any form of human rights. His popularity in the Philippines is still through the roof. The last time I looked at a poll, he had an extraordinary 85% approval rating in the Philippines. Philippine presidents don't generally get that kind of high rating, and he's been in office now long enough. It's been about 10 months, so he's beyond any kind of honeymoon period. This aura of violence that he projects gives poor Filipinos, and mind you, there are about 26 million Filipinos who live literally on a dollar a day, whose level of misery is not to be imagined. They live in sprawling, fetid slums with no water, no sewage, very limited job opportunities, hungry, their kids growing up in misery, and Duterte's killing promises them order. And when you're desperate and you're living in misery and absolute squalor, aura has an incredibly powerful appeal. And that's something that all of these strongmen offer, is a sense of order, a relief from the stress of chaos, the uncertainty that we talked about earlier.
We're talking to Alfred McCoy, history professor at UW-Madison, about the rise of authoritarian politics around the world. His piece on that topic we have linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Why do you think we're seeing this wave of elected leaders turning to populist messages and authoritarian leadership? Where do you see President Trump's actions fitting into that? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we continue our conversation with UW-Madison history professor Alfred McCoy, looking at the rise of populist authoritarian leaders in countries around the world.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see this in countries around the world? Are you familiar with some of the countries we're talking about? What do you think has changed there? Why is this a trend going on now? Do you worry about it here in the United States? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. We've got Marcus on the line in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Good afternoon. I'd like Professor McCoy to be very specific about the terminology here. This may seem like a minor quibble of language, but I think it's important. Populism, as it's understood in United States history, comes from the populist movement of the 1890s, which was an agrarian industrial worker movement generated from the ground up. What you're describing does not fit that model at all. The model it does fit is much closer to fascism. This is fascism using a populist rhetoric in order to justify itself. Trump, Duterte, Le Pen, this is much closer to fascism. And the media is completely complicit in demonizing the working class by calling this populist when it is not. I'd like you to correct this misapprehension on
Marcus,
the part of especially a media, and I'm being kind by calling it that.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Al, there have been different working definitions of populism over the years, but what do you think of what Marcus had to say?
In a sense, he's absolutely right, but in another sense, he's not right. Yes, during the 1890s, as we all know, there was a very strong populist movement based among grains farmers in the Midwest, including Wisconsin, cotton farmers in the American South. They enfolded their effort into the 1896 William Jennings Bryan Democratic Party campaign. It was a short-lived and powerful movement that left a legacy, a certain legacy of progressivism, but even that populist movement exhibited some of the traits of what we're seeing today. First of all, they were very careful in describing them, what was their moral community. It was the community of agrarians and farmers. And they also attacked their systemic enemies. They were very much opposed to bankers and banking, hence their alliance with William Jennings Bryan. They shared the attack on the gold standard. But that's over 100 years ago. Language, as we all know, constantly reinvents itself, as culture constantly reinvents itself. And this term emerged just a couple of years ago, and the media began applying it to certain of these very right-wing, violent leaders worldwide, and it's one that they embrace themselves. For example, President Trump's ambassador to the UN, former Governor Nikki Haley, has talked about this populist revolution. The White House itself uses the term. Around the world, many of these leaders embrace the term. So language has reinvented itself. I suppose you could talk about, to distinguish it, 19th century populism and this new form of 21st century populism. There are certain attributes. I mean, first of all, the ferocious identification of a people, okay, as being embattled and isolated, defining a group. And then the other thing is the determined identification of enemies. Now, President Trump has done both that. He celebrated certain aspects of the American working class, the miners, the people in manufacturing, and he's been virulent in his attacks on others, on particularly on Mexicans, on Muslims. That's been the core of his campaign, is this reciprocal, this interface between who we are and who we're not. And then in terms of President Trump as well, this performative violence, for countries like the Philippines, Duterte, the military is rather weak. They don't operate much abroad beyond their borders. So when Duterte wants to engage in performative violence, he turns his police loose on his own people. President Trump is a superpower, as a leader of a superpower, and in a country that's still ruled by law. He can't use that kind of extrajudicial violence. So he performs his violence abroad. And we've seen with President Trump the biggest drone attack in history so far, the most concentrated drone attack in Yemen, the Tomahawk missile attacks in Syria, and then that 29-pound Moab bomb that they dropped in eastern Afghanistan in the cave areas. He's raised his stature. He's, in a way, compensated for his domestic political reverses by engaging in this performative violence overseas in the way that only a superpower can do. So the term does work, but we have to adapt it for our time.
Thanks for the call, Marcus. Talking to Alfred McCoy, UW-Madison historian, looking at authoritarian leadership, authoritarians getting elected into office on what they describe as a populist message in countries around the world. Back to your calls now. Abe is on the line in La Crosse. Abe, hi.
Hi. You were talking about the policies over in the Philippines and us, the Western world, not being looking at that as a horrible thing. And I got to tell you, I don't think a lot of Westerners are averse to that anymore. We see our society deteriorating. And the other part is, I could talk to this guy for an hour. By letting all the immigrants go where they want to now, we're leaving a vacuum in the rest of the world, and that's going to let the terrorists of the world win if we just leave everything behind and let them have their way, which I think is a big win for the terrorists. We can never win a war against them if we keep taking in all the refugees of the world without having a plan to send them back again.
Abe, thanks for the call. I want to get to that first point, saying that people in the United States and the Western world might not be averse to these violent anti-crime policies that we see now in the Philippines. Kind of, the Dirty Harry sort of approach, people wanting rules to be broken in efforts against crime.
Yeah, that's one of the things the populace all share worldwide, is that they are going to either challenge the international human rights regime or certain aspects of the international community. They're going to challenge the existing political order, and they're going to reestablish a kind of moral community within the nation. And the rhetoric is therefore laden with with virulence against enemies and violence, and promises by extreme measures they're going to restore the moral community. There's also, you know, these movements very commonly identify ethnic others or some kind of other. In the Philippines, what Duterte has done is he's cast the drug users, rather than be people that are poor and that are living miserable lives and are suffering in real misery, he stigmatizes them and makes them an evil, a threat to society that have to be extirpated by these extreme measures. Just as in the United States, President Trump branded illegal Mexican immigrants and potential Muslim immigrants as an other that threaten the American community and that have to be kept off with the wall or these this extreme vetting, his phrase. So there is a tendency, I think, in the defense of the moral community as the populace defines it, to justify extreme measures in keeping out or expelling those elements that threaten that community.
Let's go back to our callers. Just a bit of time. Luis in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to express a little bit of addressing a little bit of the issue that we're talking about right now. And I feel that it's very important and beyond all the surface stuff that we're looking about populism and what's happening in the world, that we address the real core problem beyond all this kind of, yes, populism addresses certain problems and talks about the enemy and all that. At the deep root of everything, I'm from Colombia, by the way, so I have seen a little bit of what happens in the world with this, is insatisfaction. Just a plain old anger, insatisfaction with how things are in the status quo, or you want to call it establishment, and people just want something different. The establishment has not satisfied their needs, and I think that's what needs to be addressed beyond.
Got it, Luis. We're almost out of time. And Al, is there something that I guess your mainstream establishment leaders should have done, should be doing differently to address this in our last minute?
I think very clearly that in the last campaign, what we saw in the United States, just to focus on our own country for a second, is we saw two revolts against the establishment consensus. Trump, President Trump, whatever you might think of him, was definitely a rebel candidate. And in the Democratic Party ranks, there was a clear revolt against Hillary Clinton by the Bernie Sanders campaign. Hillary Clinton had very famously taken those $685,000 speaking fees from Goldman Sachs, and as a part of that, there were two dirty words that never crossed her lips: carried interest. In other words, the special tax breaks that hedge fund managers had would not be touched. Okay, and that sparked a revolt in the Democratic Party ranks. So yes, there was a genuine revolt against the establishment parties, who were very satisfied sitting on the coast, profiting from this globalization and from the current economic order, while a lot of people were suffering. And that was the surprising turn in the campaign inside both parties, actually.
We'll leave it there for now. Al, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Alfred McCoy, professor of history at UW-Madison. His books include Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation, and the forthcoming In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. We've got his piece on global authoritarian leadership linked over on the Central Time Facebook page. You can check that out there. And if you still want to share your thoughts, you can do that. Again, that's at the Central Time Facebook page.
A new CNN article asks the question, are physical books the new vinyl? The reason for this question, the sales of e-books are down by about 20% in the U.S. And you know what's up, Rob?
What is up?
I think you already know. But it's the sales of real paper books by about 7.5%.
Yeah, it seemed like the trends are going the other way for a lot of years. More ebooks, fewer physical books. Some people now apparently are making an effort to cut back on screen time, including when they're reading.
Another piece of this emerging picture, sales of e-readers declined by more than 40% between 2011 and 2016.
And yeah, I saw children's books on the way up, physical books, coloring books. They're getting big among the grown-ups now, apparently. Mm-hmm. And you can see both of those would not be wise uses of the e-reader in some cases.
There are, coloring apps and things like that that I've seen that are soothing. But there is something about the pen on the paper. I like the feel of the book, the paper on the book read. To me, there's a pleasure in a book that goes beyond just the words.
Yeah, I don't really do e-reading except for certain nerd things that I buy in PDF form. That's good on a reader. Otherwise, it's all books or audiobooks I'm doing now. Do you e-read anything?
I mean, just I consume articles and media online, No, I don't read anything extended.
No books. All right. Well, we're ahead of the times then here on Central Time.